Do we have people here on Senate Bill 53 that want to testify? Senate Bill 97, Senate Bill 104, okay, Senate Bill 224. Okay. Maybe there is a brief. Okay, pardon me? Okay, we will have a brief informational hearing first. So if you could come up, and I apologize. We do have the epidemiologist information hearing. We do have the epidemiologist who drove all the way down here from Portland and
got it. Hey, Mal, how are you doing?
Huge schedule today, and he has to leave soon, so... And I apologize for that, but we will get through this relatively quickly. So we will do the informational hearing. I'm not sure who's going first, but if you would just all introduce yourselves as you speak, that would be great.
Sure. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Gretchen Morley. As of yesterday, I'm the new Health Policy Commission director. I know many of you are familiar with Mike Bonetto and that he worked with the commission through its first year or so of development. As you know, the commission was created by the 2003 legislature and had a very broad charter to develop a plan for and monitor the implementation of the state's health policy. So the commission had been doing a years or so worth of work to look into exactly what that meant. They did develop a mission statement for the commission, which helps frame some of the issues, which was to develop and promote policy recommendations to the governor and legislature that improve the health of all Oregonians by four different mission issues: ensuring access to essential health care and support services, increasing quality and improving outcomes, controlling costs, and encouraging healthy lifestyles. That last component is the piece that we came here to talk to you today about, encouraging healthy lifestyles. With me, I have Mary Lou Henrich of the Community Health Partnership. Mary Lou served on the Commission's Health Status Work Group and is here to discuss the group's recommendations. I would note that there's a report from September that the group did to the Joint Committee on Human Services that if you don't have a copy of, we can make sure that we get one to you. We also, as was mentioned, have Melvin Cohn here, the Oregon State Epidemiologist, to also weigh in on the Commission's recommendations and issues that Mary Lou is going to discuss with you. So with that, I'll hand it over to Mary Lou.
Thank you, Gretchen, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee. My name is Mary Lou Henrich. As she told you, I am the executive director of a small nonprofit called Community Health Partnership. We have a big mission
Excuse me. Relax.
Okay.
Don't hurry.
I was trying to hurry.
No.
All right. I won't hurry. Okay.
I'm sorry because I don't want you to just brush through. We will.
Okay.
So just.
All right.
We're not going to have you read all
this, but
you can just hit the highlights.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I just point out that she's a lot better looking than Bonetto was, but that's the only
We'll go on. But I have a long history and background, as many of you know, in public health in Oregon since 1969. I'm a public health nurse, first and foremost, and have done a lot of different administrative management kinds of things in public health at Multnomah County, worked with Lori there, and then I took on developing Care Oregon, which is the largest OHP contractor to the state's Medicaid program. And I did that for about 9 years. And now I'm back into public health again. And what I'm going to try to do today is really help differentiate a bit between health and health care. Because I think that we throw the words around rather interchangeably at times. And actually, we spend most of our time focusing on health care, how to deliver it in cost-effective, quality, accessible, affordable, all those kinds of terms. And actually, as Gretchen pointed out, the Health Policy Commission had four work groups, three of which focus on health care, how to make it more accessible, more affordable, higher quality. And they had one work group on health status, and I was on that health status one. So as we're not going to really go today and talk about specific bills as much as we're going to try to talk about kind of that framework that as you do your work during this session in this committee and other committees and with your colleagues, trying to really kind of think about, okay, there is a tremendous problem with health care. And when you think health care, you think doctors, hospitals, labs, all the intricacies, the complexities of payment, who pays for what, what's in, what's out, mandates, all those kinds of things. They're very important. But at least from my perspective, it's a real conundrum at this moment on how to approach it and, quote, fix it. However, health is really much broader than health care. And even if we all had a wonderful doctor just sitting right at our sides at all times to help us and guide us and diagnose us and treat us, etc., we wouldn't necessarily be as healthy as we can be, because there are these broader issues, issues that sometimes get called lifestyle issues. And I have a little bit of trouble with the word, because it kind of connotes that kind of everyone kind of can choose their own lifestyle. Well, there certainly is a piece of individual choice in lifestyles. But there is also a lot of things that the environment either cues us up to make it easier to choose a healthy lifestyle, or makes it difficult or sometimes almost impossible to choose a healthy lifestyle. So, but when we get into these discussions, I will find people kind of throwing the words health and health care around almost interchangeably. And I think it's helpful to kind of wait, say, okay, healthcare, that's all those doctors, hospitals, insurance, all that. Health, that's the state of well-being that we all really want to have, and has strong environmental aspects that can either help us get there or keep us from being there. And so in my little background paper here, I point out that healthcare consumes 96 cents out of every dollar that is spent on health and healthcare, while public health or population-based health gets about 4 cents. Yet, I think everyone, healthcare providers as well as public health professionals and a lot of others, agree that healthcare does not make the largest contribution to good health. And over the past century, improvements such that have made our lifespan longer and more healthy are due to things like control of infectious diseases, advances in sanitation and clean water, public health actions, immunizations and vaccines, food safety regulations, restaurant inspections, vitamin and nutrient fortified pasteurized milk, seatbelt and helmet laws, which many of you helped pass, car seat laws, prohibiting smoking in workplaces and public spaces. These are just a few of the population-based public health interventions that most of us take for granted and don't think about how that really affects us in able to make healthier choices. I am healthier because I don't have to go into restaurants in Oregon and have smoke in my face anymore. I just the other night went to a restaurant in Vancouver, and the maitre d' said, smoking or non-smoking? And I was like totally shocked. I said, you mean you still believe that non-smoking smoke stays in its own section? I said, you know, I'm not coming back to Vancouver to eat dinner. I'm going back to Portland. And, you know, the guy kind of looked at me, but it was like, that allows me to be healthier because I don't have to have that smoke that's in that restaurant. So those are the things that really are environmental factors that do influence how healthy we can be. Let's see. What about children's health? I think that one of the things that the Health Status Work Group did, and there is a list kind of about midway, oh, kind of before, I have some little extra documents in the back, but kind of about midway in here, lists who was on this work group. And if you take a look at it, former Governor Roberts and Jim Lazier, the former CEO of St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, co-chaired this group. And Grant Higginson, the state health officer, was on it. A pediatrician, Jim Lace, from Salem. There was John Valley from the Heart Association. Ken Hunsaker from the Confederation of School Administrators. So there was a pretty broad-based group of us who did spend several months trying to look at what's out there in the literature, what information do we have, what kinds of things could we suggest that would make us take some more steps towards making the environments that we live, work, and play in healthier so they can help us to do the right thing and make the healthy choice, the easy choice. That's kind of the mantra that the health folks have been using. I really like it. You know, how can we make the healthy choice the easy choice? So as we got looking at data and information, and in here I talk about in healthcare, we're all familiar with the tools that healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, and others use to diagnose individual health problems. We use stethoscopes and otoscopes and blood pressure cuffs and blood tests and all kinds of things to assess and diagnose what particularly is right or wrong with each of us as individuals. But in the public health arena, we use different kinds of tools, but we still do that kind of assessment. And so we look at data information. We need to have things available like the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, BRFSS, the Healthy Teens survey that really asks teens about what do they do and their health behaviors. There's just a lot of reports, data, and that's part of what, you know, Mel can speak to in terms of his role in really kind of sifting through that, looking for best practice, looking for evidence of what works and what doesn't, and then recommending from that what should we do in terms of making statewide policy or mandates, that bad word. But those are the things that are really the public health assessment that then drives us down to saying, okay, from that, from all that data, what should we do and what do we know from science that's telling us let's try something. So the health status work group, there's a mountain of stuff out there. I'm sure you're even more aware of that than I am. It's just like, how do you kind of sift through it? So we then said, well, should we segment and take a look at, if you're going to do things to help make people healthier in the long run and you can't do everything, maybe you should start, you should look at children. You know, children are always, you know, kind of almost that blank slate that we can say, okay, if we do it right with them, then maybe we'll have healthy adults later on. So the first data that we were confronted with is the thing that you're confronted in newspapers most every day, is about the child obesity epidemic. And we looked at the data from Oregon, and Melkin has done a wonderful presentation on childhood obesity in Oregon, and it is a problem, and it is an epidemic. Do you want to comment anything more about that, or do you want me just kind of zoom on? Okay.
Well,
all right.
Let me just interrupt for a minute.
Yes.
We will have a bill dealing with that issue in terms of food, junk food,
yes,
and so on. We will have another bill which will be identical to the one on the House side dealing with the body indexing. And we want to, they're going to be a bill introduced over there and over here. I think that's, what we're looking for with that particular bill is a partner to fund it, because that's not going to go by itself. I mean, we need to have that, but it's an important tool.
Mm-hmm.
So we will have public, we will have bills on both of those, and we will invite you back at that
great
time as well.
Great.
But go ahead.
So we looked at the fact that, you know, tried to look at the health of children, and there, you know, you read the reports from Children First and from other organizations that are out there trying to grade Oregon along with other states on what is the status of our physical and mental health of children in Oregon. And the thing that seemed to rise to the top of the list for us on the health status work group was the kind of very scary information about the doubling and tripling of children being overweight. And with the implications, this is not just a cosmetic thing, I think, as you have already probably heard a lot of. This really has to do with putting them at tremendous risk for some very bad diseases like diabetes, heart disease, very young. And then when you try to kind of look at the economic impacts, not just the personal impacts on the kids, but the economic impacts down the road, that if, you know, right now people who are adults getting type 2 diabetes are oftentimes in their 60s or 70s. And so with the lifespan, by the time diabetes really does the terrible ravages it can do, you know, the person is pretty much towards the end of their life. But if you get this type 2 diabetes in your teens, early 20s, or even 30s, and you have about 20 years before the real ravages, the visual problems, the neurologic problems, all of those things start happening, they're going to start hitting when people are still in their supposed best work years. And what is that going to mean for all of us? Say it starts happening 20 years from now. People like me are going to be, in our late 70s and 80s. And we're going to be approaching this kind of broken down healthcare system that we're already struggling with in droves, this baby boom generation. And then we're going to have on top of it these very sick people in their midlife who should be healthy because we didn't do something to prevent that from happening. So when you looked at all of this together, this health status work group said, we need to think about what could we suggest about kids. What could be manipulated in the environment to make it better for them? And so that's where the idea of nutritional standards for foods sold in schools is one. Minimum minutes of PE. There is a bill that's Senator Courtney's introducing that would set standards for elementary and middle school. Now, we know these things aren't going to be easy, and schools are feeling very beleaguered and very much like their budgets are, in terrible shambles. But it's kind of like, okay, how can we come together and do something besides just say, geez, we can't do anything here, and just let the game keep playing? So we looked at those issues. We also looked at the tobacco issue, and have we, gone as far as we can go? And no, we haven't. And we actually felt that some of the data showed that we were really kind of dropping back with the repeal of that 10-cent cigarette tax. We know that every time we increase the price of cigarettes, it makes it less accessible to youth. Well, we're one of the, we have the notorious thing now of our state being the only state that I think has dropped our cigarette tax. And so we definitely need to get it back and, from our perspective, add to it. Not just because it would bring in revenue for things so that we could have continuing cessation programs and prevention programs, but more around that issue of being a deterrent to teen smoking.
Now, may I?
Yes.
Just a moment. I heard recently, and I haven't verified the numbers, but there's a huge amount of cigarettes being sold over the internet that we don't seem to have any control over, and I'm wondering how we can deal with that.
Maybe I'll let Dr. Cohn answer that, because I have talked to some people in his office about it, but he probably has the most current.
Chair Morissette, the best data that we have, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn, I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services. The best data that we have on that suggests that about 3% of cigarettes consumed in Oregon are currently sold over the internet. Now, that number has been increasing, and that is of some concern. And, of course, any cigarette that is sold over the internet, there are the issues about tax collection associated with that, that, if the taxes are not paid, that's essentially lost revenue for the state. So that is an increasing problem, but and one that I think the Department of Justice and some other of the law enforcement folks in the state are looking at how to best address. It's a difficult problem.
I had heard a much higher figure that I really made me wonder. Mm-hmm. 3% is bad, but it's not nearly. I heard one that was 10 times higher than that, and I don't know where that came from.
No, that was the number I'd been hearing.
And I don't know if that was an Oregon figure, if it was national or whatever, but obviously it's an issue.
Chair Morissette, yeah, that 3% number comes from our survey where we ask people where they get their cigarettes, also how much they smoke and
you
so forth.
You ask kids where they get their?
No, this comes from an adult survey.
Well, that's an interesting question, because you can't order a six-pack of beer over the internet, but you can order a carton of cigarettes, if you're underage, and have it delivered, but parents would not be aware of that. But, okay.
It's an issue.
Thank you.
Also, the issue of when we were then considering issue around cigarette smoke and tobacco usage, we did kind of applaud Oregon for its early efforts in clean air and the workplace restrictions on smoking, restaurants, etc. But we did note that we still do have the exemption for bars and bowling alleys that do subject up to 40,000 workers who have no choice. They can't make that healthy choice because they have to go there to work. Musicians, people who work in those bars and bowling alleys. And so concerned that we should continue to rethink that and see whether we can't do better and assure all of our workforce that we care about their health and we're going to try to help make it easy for them to do the right thing. So we looked at that. We also looked at issues related to oral health and the tremendous problems that we have with dental caries in children, especially poor children who don't have access to dental care. And so the issue of water fluoridation, which is always, I know, one that, you know, most everybody just kind of wants to run from. You say the words, and it's like, do I even mention it here? But I have to. Because, you know, the best scientific evidence, in my mind, and a lot of us who consider it, seems to be amassed saying that it is clear that we should have our public water systems fluoridated, and in Oregon we have most people, over 70%, do not have fluoride in the water systems where they live, and we have got some of the worst child dental carie problems in the nation, and it seems like something that for a relatively small investment, you have a tremendous yield in terms of pain and suffering reduction as well as the economics. But I'm not going to harangue on it.
I think there are bills on both sides of that issue
this
time.
Yes, there are. So I'm just having to kind of recount to you the way we looked and discussed these issues and to let you know that we tried to use those tools of epidemiology, looking at data, looking at trends, looking at subpopulations within the whole population, looking at where does the burden of illness fall the hardest. And I don't think it's any surprise to you that it's clear that the burden of illness, many chronic illnesses, falls much more heavily on poor and people of color who don't have good access to health care and oftentimes don't have environments where they live, work, and play that make it possible for them to get the exercise, to get the nutritious food, the affordability, all those things do come in on the environmental side too. So in review, I think that the committee felt that we would put forward some of these beginning ideas and concepts. We believe that, you know, others will be putting forward similar or, you know, variations on the theme, that we want to stand ready to assist you in analyzing these various proposals, debating and discussing the various options that we would have to really improve those environments and bring you information. And to leave you with a few thoughts, that health care does not equal health. Healthy lifestyles definitely have an individual component, but the environment makes it either much easier or much harder to make those good choices. While there's a general lack of consensus around how to fix the health care system, there is much consensus among a lot of groups. There are lots of broad coalitions forming, and health care providers, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Public Health Association, the PTA, a lot of groups that are coming around and saying, we think we can find where the consensus is on how we can modify the environments, especially as they relate to children's health. So I think there is hope. And that's the other thing, that having been in public health and health care for all of these years, I think, as many of you must feel, I know, you know, having talked with Senator Cruz about these, I mean, some days it feels pretty hopeless about the mess that we're in with the healthcare system and how do we fix it, with everybody on every side of the issue and arguing, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that. And kind of some days you kind of go home feeling, you know, what, do we just wait for it to implode? I mean, what do we do? Mm-hmm. But I think that on the side of health for the population, I'm really invigorated and excited and hopeful as I talk with so many people from different viewpoints, from business, from parent advocates, from schools, the Department of Ed, all these people kind of coming around and saying, we can do something, and that we look for your leadership to be courageous as leaders in the past have been when we did things like the bottle bill way before its time and public ownership of beaches and those kinds of things that were controversial. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I'm sure some of the leaders at the time, you know, had a lot of people kind of ragging on them one way or the other. But they really stepped forward and said, we think there's a pretty much consensus here. Let's go for it. So that's what I'm here for, and Dr. Cohn wants to comment. At the end of your packet, I put in just a few little backgrounder pages. These are from a national organization that the former Surgeon General David Satcher is heading up. It's called Action for Healthy Kids. Oregon has a group that is Oregon's version of Action for Healthy Kids called Nutrition in Schools. And so this is just some of the information that links, and I think the other thing is that we're starting to have data out there that shows there is definitely a link between healthy, well-nourished, well-exercised children and their ability to do well in school and have lower behavioral problems and higher academic test scores. And I think that the Healthy Kids Coalition is bringing together that education and health folks to see, and we're going to have a lobby day next Tuesday, so we'll be looking for you to drop in on us.
Good, thank you. Dr. Cohn, have you had an opportunity to have a Zen moment before you start?
Jim Morissette, members of the committee, I don't know if Zen is quite the way to describe it, but I've been listening to Mary Lou.
You have to relax and let things happen.
Yeah. Cleansing breath.
No, I have a Zen moment.
You come from Eugene.
Thank you. I hope I haven't destroyed your opening.
No, not at all. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for giving me an opportunity to come and present today. I have to say that I was really very pleased when I heard that the Health Policy Commission was going to have this subcommittee that was going to talk about health. Because as Mary Lou says, much of the debate around health that gets airtime is usually about health care, and actually even more specifically than that, about health insurance. Now, I don't mean to say that health care or health insurance are not important. Of course they're important, but they are one piece of what keeps people healthy. And in fact, you know, Mary Lou talked about life expectancy since 1900. Life expectancy has increased about 30 years since 1900. Think about that. That's really quite amazing. But when you look at those 30 years, almost 25 of those 30 years are attributable to changes in public health, to changes in our environment, some of the things that Mary Lou referred to, not to health care, but to public health. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind as we think about how to guard the health and promote the health of Oregonians. Now, the topics that the Health Policy Commission has chosen to focus on, I'm also pleased about because I think they're very important public health topics. Tobacco is far and away the leading preventable cause of death and disability in Oregon. About 18 Oregonians a day die from tobacco-related illness. Think about that for a minute. I mean, if this were an infectious disease, everything would be going wild right now. But this is a health threat that we just kind of take for granted. It's in the background most days. Obesity and the diseases associated with it are fast on the tails of tobacco, increasing dramatically. And this issue about obesity in children is particularly alarming because there's very good data to suggest that kids who have trouble with obesity go on to become not only obese adults, but extremely obese adults. And it's those folks, particularly on the high end of the body mass index spectrum, that are really the big cost drivers of a lot of the cost burden related with obesity. So I think that that focus is also very, very appropriate. Finally, I just wanted to add one thing to just kind of illustrate for you, maybe in a concrete kind of way, this issue about the environment and how that determines not only your personal choices, but also your health status in many ways. And I think about the example of tobacco. You know, if you're a smoker and you go to your health care provider and your provider tells you you should quit smoking because you've got, I don't know, you're short of breath, and, you know, if you quit smoking, your breathing would be a lot easier. Well, you may or may not pay attention to that provider. I mean, of course, everybody always listens to what their doctor says completely and does exactly what they tell them. But chances are, we all know that, you know, you'll you'll maybe look down at your shoes for a little bit and feel a little guilty, and by the time you're out of the office in your car, you will have moved on to something else. But what happens if you hear that message from your doctor, and that's, you know, it registers with you? You go out and you get in your car and you're driving back home, and you turn on the radio and you hear an advertisement that's talking about the dangers of secondhand smoke and what a problem this is posing to you. You get into your office, and in your office you're not allowed to smoke. Right in the office, you have to go somewhere else to smoke. It becomes a little more of a hassle, and you start to think, well, you know, this really isn't something I want to do. And then you go home, and you know, your wife says to you, honey, I really don't want you to smoke in the house. It stinks up the whole house. Would you please go out on the porch? And your kids come up, and my kids are always giving me a hard time about anything they can possibly give me a hard time about, but your kids have gotten this message and start telling you that you should quit smoking. So you get the idea. When you hear these repeated messages from all around you in the environment, that's when behavior change starts to happen. Now, the piece that happens in the doctor's office is the province of healthcare. And, you know, we need to have doctors and other healthcare providers delivering those messages, absolutely. It's all that other stuff in the environment that really is the bailiwick of public health. And I think you can look at that kind of model for any of these diseases, whether it's obesity or diabetes or so on and so forth. And that's really how public health works and where public health works. So with that, I'm going to stop. I'll be happy to answer questions or comments that any of the members of the committee would like to make. Thank you.
It's interesting because I think that the mores of a society are more powerful than laws. Now, we do have laws that require us to do things, but we do them because of pressure from society more than whether or not it's a law. And I think the mores have changed with both smoking and drinking. I think that both things that, you know, they used to be quite prevalent among all ages, even kids, and I think that's changing because public opinion is changing about them. And so I think the laws reinforce it, but they don't cause it. A law cannot cause someone to do or not do something. Unless it's, well, no, really, I mean, if I, anyway, I think the mores are changing, and I think what you're saying is true, because you get the message from a lot of different areas, and that does change. Questions? Comments? Okay. Thank you very much for being here. And as we go along, we will have some bills, and we will invite you back.
Great.
But we wanted to hear some reports from the task force that met, and we will continue to. There are three other areas that Senator Morris Anderson's committee will also hear portions of it, and each of us will deal with some of the bills that come out of that.
Well, we thank you for your time and interest.
Yeah, thank you. I think the bill dealing with the PE issue is in your committee. Yeah, in fact, is that right?
Education.
Oh, that hasn't been introduced yet.
If you walk this line.
Okay. I don't know where that will be then. But
we'll see. Thanks.
Good. Thank you very much.
Education
committee. That bill is in the education committee. I knew it was somewhere. Thank you very much. Okay, we will close the public informational part of the hearing, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 53. David Koch. Okay. Yeah, the mortuary and cemetery board. So, David, if you yes.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 53 briefly just increases the fee for filing of a certificate of death with the Department of Human Services and increases the amount allocated to the operation of the board. In brief, the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board was created to license funeral establishments, funeral service practitioners, embalmers, and others. The board is composed of 11 members appointed by the governor. The board is also self-supporting and derives its financing from licensing, examination, and death certificate filing fees. Board's major duties include impartial oversight, regulation, testing, review, registration, certification, and discipline of licensees. This includes regular inspections of licensed facilities and investigation of complaints. this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is David Coe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. The board is a small other funds agency. It has a full-time staff of six, including two investigators who are employed to perform facility inspections and complaint investigations. I'm here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 53, which proposes a $3 increase in the death certificate filing fee. The $3 increase, if enacted, will generate about $140,000 in new revenue during the 05-07 biennium. The board is not proposing any new programs or additional staff. That new revenue is needed in order to resolve a revenue shortfall and preserve the board's current capacity to conduct mandatory facility inspections and complaint investigations. The death certificate filing fee was first established by the legislature in 1985. It was intended to provide revenue for the board to implement a number of reforms passed in the wake of what has become known as the Omsberg incident. Omsberg was a funeral director who owned a funeral home and a cemetery in Lincoln City in 1984. He horribly abused scores of human remains and brought tragedy to the families, many families in the Lincoln City area who were already suffering from the loss of a loved one. Attached to my written testimony are three excerpts from the board's budget document. Required revenue shortfall package 070, policy package 171, and policy package 172. When an agency lacks the revenue to continue operations at the current level, budget policy requires that the agency submit a revenue shortfall package reducing expenditures to meet available revenue. In order to do that, in this case, the board was compelled to eliminate both of its investigator positions in revenue shortfall package 070. Senate Bill 53 is tied directly to policy package 171, which proposes to restore one of the two investigator positions with new revenue derived from the death certificate filing fee increase. Policy package 172 proposes to restore the second position with revenue from a license fee increase. Taken together, policy packages 171 and 172 represent a compromise worked out after two previous efforts to resolve the revenue shortfall problem failed. During the 2003 legislative session, the legislature rejected Senate Bill 347, which called for a $7 increase in the death certificate filing fee. Although that bill had the support of industry and consumers alike, the Education Ways and Means Subcommittee instead directed the board to return to the emergency board with a license fee increase sufficient to resolve the revenue shortfall problem. The board obtained approval from the Department of Administrative Services for a license fee increase and was tentatively placed on the emergency board agenda for the November 2003 session, but the board was scratched from the agenda apparently due to lack of industry support. My understanding is that the Oregon Funeral Directors Association felt that the proposed license fee increase was too high. Since then, the board and the Oregon Funeral Directors Association have worked out a compromise calling for a smaller license fee increase and a smaller death certificate filing fee increase. Ratification of the license fee increase is requested separately in House Bill 5037. In addition to OFDA, Senate Bill 53 has the support of the Oregon Cemetery Association and the Oregon Funeral Consumer Alliance, which is a 14,000-member consumer advocacy group. The board is not aware of any opposition to the proposed increase in the death certificate filing fee. I've kept my remarks brief. It's my understanding that this bill may be referred to another committee. I'd be happy to go into further detail. I think the attachments provide sufficient detail, but I'd be happy to discuss it further or answer any questions you might have.
Questions?
Mr. Brenneman, are you? Would you like to come up, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, and David has presented to you an exact description of what happened. Membership was not supportive of the proposed fee increase. There was a work group that could not come to agreement, and the board went ahead with the higher license fees, and then we had a dispute at the emergency board, which put us back at the table, and this is what we agreed to, and this is what we came up with, and we urge the committee to move it on to Ways and Means.
Let's do that, clear. Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53 and open a work session on Senate Bill 53.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 53 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. Discussion? Okay. Is there disagreement with the motion? Any concerns? Okay, seeing no concerns with the motion being made, motion passes. The bill will go to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee. Very good. Thank you. Okay, the next public hearing possible work session will be on Senate Bill 97. Mr. Bukovic, would you like some overview?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 97 authorizes the State Board of Massage Therapists to establish the expiration date of licensees by rule. In brief, the Board of Massage Therapists regulates the practice of massage. The board licenses massage therapists, establishes continuing education requirements, promotes education, administers tests, et cetera. There are currently 5,200 active or inactive licensees in Oregon, and under current statute, licensees must renew their license biannually by December 1st of even-numbered years. Thank you, Senator.
That's fine.
I'm done. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
If you would introduce yourselves before you speak, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Michael Jordan. I'm a licensed massage therapist and also chair of the State Massage Board. As indicated, we are licensing at this time 5,200 massage therapists. By contrast, in 2001, there was 3,300. The ability of an office staff of three to process 5,200 applications in a one-month time is somewhat overwhelming and impossible. We have decreased our staff in the last couple of years by 25%, and so by moving to a system which the relicensing period would be still every 2 years, but moving to a system that might be similar to the brick month or something of that nature, to allow the board to be able to set the renewal period. It'll still be a two-year renewal period, and all the other requirements will still be in place. It would just change it to a more spread out over the year. Mm-hmm. And if we went to a monthly type of a renewal, we would change it from doing 5,200 to about 250 in a month. A lot more doable.
Sounds reasonable.
Mr. Chair, we have done this for other boards in the past couple sessions, so this is it's kind of a trend, I think. So,
yes, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank
please?
You, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. Patty Glenn, I'm the executive director for the Board of Massage Therapists, and again, just here in support and to let you know that we have communicated this change several times since I became the executive director in May of last year, or this proposed change to our massage therapists. It's been put out in our Borderline newsletter. It's also been communicated in the American Massage Therapy Association's newsletter just recently. We've had nothing but support by the members of the massage therapists in the community. They're really thrilled with the idea of getting this away from the Christmas season, being able to deal with it at a time when they might be more reminiscent, or not reminiscence, not the right word, but when they might remember that date better. And a birth month, birth year type system would accomplish that. We have looked at several different options, quarterly renewals, birth month, birth year. So they would, for instance, a May 67 birthday would renew in May of odd-numbered years, et cetera. Seems to be the trend that would make the most sense, create the most even spread in workflow and revenue over the biennium. Okay. And we're just here to answer any questions you might have regarding this bill and appreciate your time.
Chair Morrison, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Allen. I manage the state's Office of Regulatory Streamlining. We're a co-requester on the bill. This is one of about three dozen bills that that various agencies have submitted to make regulations for business simpler, faster, cheaper, improve customer service. Some of the bills represent big changes in public policy. Some, like this bill, are fairly small but important kinds of changes that help us do business better, and we think by virtue of doing lots of small changes, we can improve the state's regulatory climate. And in fact, Earth Month license renewal is something that we're promoting as a best practice to licensing agencies as a way to improve customer service.
Okay, thank you. Massage therapists should start their session with a Zen moment. Do you do that?
Maybe we were feeling a little more Zen here.
It must be the tie.
Well, when things are kind of tense, you just have to take a minute, right?
Maybe I should ask you how the testimony was. You might let me know if I needed it.
No. Testimony was fine. I'm talking about our.
Stop that.
Questions?
Just a comment, Ms. Chair. I think this is appropriate, and yes. this is something that is working, because, like I said, we've done it for other.
Yeah.
Other folks in previous sessions. I guess the only complaint I would have was, I think in 99, the first session I chaired the House Health and Human Services Committee, we ran a lot of massage therapy bills, and they had a massage therapy day in the Capitol, and we've had one every session, and so far I have not received a massage, so I just thought I'd point that out.
Chair Morset, members of the committee, there are 2 days scheduled this session, so keep your eyes and ears peeled, and there will be opportunities.
Mr. Chair, I complained about it at the time because we were doing their bills and they set up a special session and to come to my office and do a massage and I got called into the speaker's office, so my staff got one, so you know it's a conspiracy, I think, Mr. Chair.
Well, this year we have chiropractor day every day.
Oh.
We have a resident chiropractor every single day, so you guys
sounds like you need a resident massage therapist. So I do know that thanks to the American Massage Therapy Association, those 2 days will be happening. Okay. One in March, I believe, and one in May.
So. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Others to testify. Seeing no others, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 97 and open the work session on Senate Bill 97.
I move Senate Bill 97 to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 97 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, just to say my comments during the public hearing were all in jest, so just for the record.
Well, okay. Hearing no objections, we will send Senate Bill 97 to the floor, and Senator Cruz can carry it in his comments to the floor.
Okay, we can do that.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 104.
Let me briefly review this, Senator.
Yes, please.
And I will be very brief. This is full of some highly technical language, so I will defer to our invited public speakers to describe some of this. This bill does remove language that allows an individual to be licensed as a diagnostic radiologic technician by successfully completing a course from approved school and passing the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists. Or equivalent board approved examination. It also removes language that allows a person to be licensed as a therapeutic radiologic technician or RT by the course or by getting an equivalent approved examination. This does require, the bill requires a person who operates both computed tomography, CT equipment not using radionuclides, be certified by the national organization, the ARRT. and then requires that a person who operates CT equipment combined with a positron emission tomography or a PET scan imaging system for diagnostic purposes adhere to rules set by the board. In brief, the Board of Radiologic Technology was established in 77 to monitor license both therapeutic technologists, diagnostic technicians, limited permit examinations, and similar. There has been, in the last several years, I understand, a movement toward combining both CT and PET scan machines, which creates some problems, I understand, in the persons who are licensed to use such machines, and sometimes they have to kind of duplicate staff to operate one machine. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Welcome. If you'd like, introduce yourselves and when you give testimony.
Thank you.
Stereo.
I'm Ernest Wick. I'm the chair of the OBRT, and I'm from Pendleton, Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee. We're here to ask for your support in the language change, which allows the board to change the statute with your blessing, and at the same time answer any kind of questions that you might have in regards to this bill.
Yes,
please. Okay, and I appreciate Rick's abuse of the English language in his explanation. He's using all the big words. And thank you very much, Rick. I'm glad to see that you've learned some of those words. In plain English, what does this change do? I mean, you're removing something and you're replacing it with something. Who is this impacting?
Mr. Chairman and the committee, the statute states that an RT is the only person qualified to operate a CT scanner.
Okay.
And this language change allows the board to oversee licensing folks where they have a CT scanner and a PET scanner combination. At the same time, it allows the board to oversee operators of a CT scanner and a combined system of nuclear medicine. That's it in a nutshell.
Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I read it is for licensure as a radiologic technologist, all you have to do is be currently certified by the American Registry of Radiologic Technologies in X-ray technology. And the thing that's deleted is they do not now have to complete a course of study. And so that's how I read it. So you can do on-the-job training. Is that what this is saying?
Can I speak? My name is Linda Russell. I'm the executive officer for the Board of Radiologic Technology. And this bill, when it first started out, was simply to clarify the language in our statute so that, like Ernest has tried to explain, some of the newer technologies, which the PET-CT is part of that, it was to... In our statutes as it exists right now, it states in there that our RTs are...
Instead of you, Mr. Chair, for the public's benefit, instead of using all of the acronyms, okay. If you could...
Thank you.
And for our benefit, too. Thank you.
Yeah, you forget when you're working it all the time. Excuse me. Radiologic technologist is what the RT stands for, and these are individuals who went to a two-year college program through an accredited school, and most of the colleges get these students ready to take the national boards, and that is through the American Society of Radiologic Technology, and they become certified, and it's the national body that's recognized in all of, I think, except for 18 states that don't have a particular type of state licensure at this time. So what we were attempting to do is to take out the redundancy in our language to allow for this new technology and to specify that not only do they need to be certified through ARRT, but for different types of...
ART.
The American Society of Radiologic Technology. Forgive me. I'm a little bit nervous today.
No, you're doing great.
take a Zen moment here.
Okay. We all need Zen moments. Thank you. You're wonderful.
See? We're going to start calling him the Zen Master.
Yes, we need to. Thank you. So, along with their national certification, we didn't feel it was necessary to still have that language in there about them requiring the educational aspect, because to be certified through the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists, they are required to have that education as just the preliminary to be allowed to sit for that exam. So that is part of the reason why that was taken out. And it was also to, let's see, correct a couple things in there. To be more specific with the language with the CT, PET CT is one of the technologies, and you'll have to forgive me, I'm not a technologist myself, and so that's why Ernest is here today. He is a radiologic technologist, and he's also the imaging director at St. Anthony's Hospital in Pendleton. And so the technical aspect he can certainly help you with. But it was to, what we're trying to attempt here is allow for facilities like OHSU and other facilities that have this new equipment to be able to use one person to operate this equipment rather than using two individuals. Right now they're using a radiologic technologist and also a certified nuclear medicine individual.
Technology.
And they're each doing their portion of it to come out with this advanced imaging, which is superb, my understanding is. And with certain types of training, the understanding is that they could take, it's easier to give specific training to the nuclear medicine technologist to adapt to the CT portion that the radiologic technologists are doing so that they could do this one process instead of the two individuals. And that's what the language is, the change is all about. It's
Let me ask. As long as you're going to carry this, Bill, do you understand?
But follow up, though.
You take a good moment.
Okay. Do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. I just need section on page 1, section 2, lines 26, 27, 28, and 29. On 23, it's dealing with this. For licensure as a radiologic technologist in the diagnostic field, an applicant must, and it has number one, be, you know, currently certified. But then number two, it says, have successfully completed a course of study in an approved school of radiologic technology. But and it's removing that section, yet you're saying that they already have to do that, but it's then mentioned somewhere else and we don't need it here. I'm just confused.
It's a prerequisite, if you could call it that. They need the education in order to sit for the national certification examination through the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists. We thought it was redundant to have that language in there, and that's why we wanted to take it out. It's nothing more than that.
All right.
Let me also, Mr. Chairman and the committee, let me add that you already have...
Identify yourself one more time.
Ernest Wick, the chairman of the board. The thoughts behind it was is that if you are qualified and sit for the national exam, that you've already had that education. Does that help clarify it a little bit?
That's the requirement to sit is to have
that. That's correct.
So, follow up then.
Yes.
So... someone could take that exam without having taken a course of study.
No, they cannot.
No.
Okay, that's what I wanted to have stated.
Yes.
Okay, while we're dissecting the bill, could we turn to Section 4?
Yes.
What we're adding, and I guess we're differentiating between people that use radioactive stuff and people that don't, I guess. I mean, because on lines 9 and 10, you say not involving the use of radionuclides, which I assume is radioactive stuff. And but you're talking about them being able to do somebody being able to do the whole thing, and yet the language says that they cannot do that. So how does that get us from point A to point B? Am I missing something here? I mean, quite clearly, if you get into sub two, it says with a positron emission tomography, is that that almost sounds like particles, but it's certainly not radionuclides. So I guess the terms are confusing me. You're talking about currently to do these things, it takes two people, and you want to get it to where one person can be qualified to do it. I guess I'm having a confusion. If you're adding exclusionary language, how that gets one person to do two parts.
And what you're saying is correct, in that we want to take it from two people to one, but at the same time, we want to be able to, as a board, oversee the qualifications of that person operating that joint piece of equipment.
Okay, now, I guess I will ask at this point, is this a correctly drafted bill? Could it be simplified? Maybe it's okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, just what confused me is we have basically in Section 4, we're defining two people with two different skill sets that can be certified, it appears to me, but we're excluding the use of radionuclides in one, and we're including the use of positron emissions, and I guess that confused me. What are those two things?
The PET scanner,
right?
And the radionuclei. The radionuclei is the substance,
right?
It's radioactive,
uh-huh.
And the PET scanner is the device to detect that,
right? Okay, well, what is the positron emission? Is that what it's detecting with the...
That's the test.
That's
the equipment that's used to detect the isotope.
Are there definitions preceding this? Okay, I'm wondering if this is... did you have this drafted?
Yes, we did.
Okay, and who did you work with legislative counsel?
Charlie Cheek.
Okay.
It'd be nice to get Charlie Cheek.
Well, no, I just wonder if we shouldn't write a bill that people can understand. I mean, this is going to go in the statute book, and people will look at this and are going to wonder perhaps what it means. I wonder if there isn't a better way of saying it.
You think I'm making more of this than I should?
I think so.
Well, maybe.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not saying this.
Okay, good.
Okay.
And if you understand it, you can carry it. Go ahead.
Well, in the Section 4, the way I read that, okay. you've got one person who is dealing with the computed tomography equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the same person who might be using that equipment could also use the other as long as he qualified under the rules adopted by the Board of Radiologic Technology.
He's got it.
Okay. Okay. I have no problem.
No,
let's move on.
Very well.
Okay, that's right. Well, Mr. Chair, I was just thinking we're defining two different people, but we're defining two different qualifications.
Okay. Right. Now, while we're waiting for Charlie Cheek to get here, I have another question. What kind of patient risk is there in this procedure? Because we're talking this is no ordinary X-ray, or is it?
That is correct. We are not talking about ordinary X-ray.
Okay, but is there a patient risk in...
what constitutes overexposure to this procedure? Is this something that, if done often, would anything done too often would cause damage, but is there any particular risk in this procedure?
Mr. Chairman, there's no additional risk at this point in general, because right now you have PET scanners by themselves, mm-hmm. and you have CT scanners by themselves, mm-hmm. and the technologists who are operating those equipment are overseen by medical professionals.
I'm not talking about the risk to the operators. I'm talking about the risk to the patient.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is that they're, in addition to the operator, the patient is overseen by the physician.
Wait. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, because I want everyone to hear this. Yeah.
There's no additional risk because the CT scanners, the computerized tomography scanners, and the PET scanners are currently now being used, and they're in a separate environment, and the physicians and radiologists oversee the technologists and the patient's procedure.
Is there any literature out that talks about risk to patients, undue risk? Are you aware of any?
Yeah, there is literature out there in regards to each of those modalities in terms of the risk as far as exposure and drug administration. And that's why it's overseen by qualified technologists.
This is one of those instances that when I'm driving and I listen to NPR and I hear a report, and I believe it's been a while, but I believe it was over the CAT scanners that there is cautionary concerns about the frequency that people have some of these tests, and they warn people that don't overdo it and take it seriously and so on. That's yeah, okay, that's fine.
Right.
Now we are going to
okay. We took a vote in the committee, Mr. Chair. We're okay.
Good. Okay. Great. Great. And then this will be each of you will have a crack at it then on the floor if you need it.
Okay. We had a Zen moment.
Good. We had a Zen moment. I'm glad. Okay. Good. Other questions then? Okay. Anything else you want to add to that?
No.
I just appreciate your support. And I apologize. We didn't have a handout for you today. Actually, this is our first time coming.
And
we did well.
We did well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And we just didn't really know the procedures. So
well,
we apologize.
Thank you. No, thank you for being here. I know you came a long way, so thank you very much.
The next one is us again. Do you want us to stay?
Pardon?
The next bill is us again.
Oh, okay.
Do you want
okay.
us to just stay?
Well, no, let's yeah. finish. Well, let's,
yeah. let's finish this one.
Sit right there.
Oh, sit right there. Okay, I'm. Chair's overruled. Go
Nice way you moved all those bills before I got here last time, right?
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 204, and we will open 104, and we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 202.
Mr. Chair, I would advise that we open a work session.
Okay, just sit where you are. We're going to do the work session then. Thank you very much. We will we've closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 104. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 104.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 104 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there comments, discussion? Are there objections? Seeing no comments or objections, we will move Senate Bill 104 to the floor. And Senator Starr, would you be good enough to carry this bill with backup and support from
the only one that understands
it? Thank you very much. And we will now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 224. And would you please give us an overview?
Thank you, Chair. And just briefly, this does increase the number of members on the Board of Radiologic Technology from 7 to 9. As the Vice Chairperson, the Board requires annual election of this position, establishes the number of members required for a quorum, and establishes the date of the new Board memberships of the two members will expire. I've already described the background of the Board, and again, it's currently comprised of 7 members appointed by the Governor. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Introduce yourselves again for this public hearing, please.
Chair Morissette, Linda Russell, the Executive Officer for the Board of Radiologic Technology. We are here today to ask you and the committee for your support on our Senate Bill 224 to increase the size of our board membership. The main reasons for that, of course, would be that we would like to be able to strengthen the knowledge and experience that we have on the board presently and bring in another public member, have the option of bringing in another public member. And as we talked about previously, the industry is changing rapidly. We'd like to be able, instead of specifying who that other member would be of what modality, we would like to leave that open so it could be, you know, frequently changed as the need would be. But we'd like to bring more diversity to our board. We'd like to have more representation across the state. We just feel that it would be easier to take the boards, committees, and different involvements that they have and be able to carry out the board business much equally distributed if we had an additional few members to do that. Looking at the overall cost, I had to kind of come up with an average price of what I felt it might cost for two new members, and that would be under $1,500 a biennium for that, and I believe that the benefits would definitely outweigh the cost for our agency, and would hope that you would support us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Did you have any?
Mr. Chair?
Question.
I notice that I'm looking at the types of people that you have on your committee, and you say one member shall be a radiologist and at least one member shall be a layperson, and then five members are a licensed practicing radiologic technologist. So you're... So when you add two more, are those probably going to be licensed practicing radiologic technologists, or you said you wanted to expand, but what other professions?
At this time, we did not want to have to specify what those two other membership would represent, but the board is... would like to have another public member. We think it's always good to bring the public in and have that business sense about the board. And then with the rapid change in technology, we didn't want to find ourselves limiting it again as we have kind of been catching up with technology. So we felt it would be better if we could leave that open to whatever the modalities are that are interested on serving on our board and that the board is getting involved with. And it was kind of a way of looking at the future. And that's why we did not specify a specific modality.
And just follow up. And what kind of decisions or advisory type duties does the board come up with?
Our board sets all of the policies. We are, of course, a regulatory board, and so we have a lot of complaints and investigations that come forth. Our board reviews all of that. They make their recommendations. They are the ones that set our disciplinary actions that we follow. The board basically, they run the agency. We are the staff, myself and my other staff members, and we carry out their work. And it takes a lot. They meet in their committees, and they try to do the best that they can for the profession. And at the same time, having to be a regulatory board, and they take great pride in that because, really, they're protecting all of Oregonians by being there. And they're volunteers. And some of them, like Ernest, for one, he got into town at 11:45 last night. That shows his dedication. He believes in what we're doing, and I'm very thankful to have him. Well, honestly.
Thank you.
Can I add to that, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In addition to that,
this
is Ernest Wick. I'm the chair of the OBRT. In addition to that, we oversee all the schools that teach X-ray in the state. We also inspect those schools. We review their exam results. We also approve all of the teachers in those programs. And at the same time, we are responsible for the renewal of each of those licenses throughout the year, both registered radiologic technologists and limited licensed technologists also.
Other questions? For the record, your fee structure will take care of the cost of additional board members.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Others wishing to testify? Seeing no one wishing to testify, I will close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 224 to the floor with Dukas recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 224 to the floor with a Dukas recommendation. Discussion? Any opposition? Seeing no opposition, Senate Bill 224 will go to the floor with a Dukas recommendation, and Senator Bonas Anderson has volunteered to carry the bill. I think everyone but me now has an assignment.
Good.
I'm sure I like it.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for being here.
A pleasure.
You had to come a long way. Thank you. Thank you. And any other business from the committee? Seeing no other business from the committee, we will adjourn. Thank you.